Okay, well, we are finding ourselves in 1 Samuel chapter 25. I was having a hard time coming up with a title for this one. I didn't know if I should call it the brash, the bad, and the beautiful, or the wrathful, the wicked, and the wise. I opted for the second one because it really kind of highlights the individual who deserves, you know, some glory here, some honor, and that is, of course, Abigail, as she is the wise one in this particular passage. As I was, you know, I've looked at this passage before, and as I looked at it this time, I'm convinced that this is an excellent passage for men and women, especially married men and women, because we have an instance here where a woman has some really sound advice, and it needs to be heeded. David, of course, heeds it, and Nabal, her husband, no one can speak to him. But we're going to be looking at just the first 22 verses here tonight, and then we'll save the remainder, really the where most of the lessons reside, in the second half of the chapter. But again, chapter 22 sets up this contrast. We're kind of, right now, we're apart from that contrast. Not to say that it isn't applicable, because we see here, well, I'll get to it in a minute, but let's just talk about this first. Back in chapter 22, we see Saul slaughtering a city of priests who are anointed by the Lord. And here we see David twice sparing cities that were proved disloyal to him, and then also sparing Saul twice, the Lord's anointed. Chapter 24, verse 13, the instance we looked at on Sunday night, we had the proverb there, out of the wicked comes forth wickedness. So again, conduct speaks to character. What you are on the inside will come out on the outside. In the case of David, he is a man after God's own heart, so we consistently see obedience. And with Saul, we see someone who has a heart that is against God, that is rebelling against God, and therefore wickedness comes forth from him. Now, again, we might expect the author to jump from chapter 24 to chapter 26. Instead, he inserts this account about David, Nabal, and Abigail. And the question becomes, why? It's interesting. David consistently says he spares the Lord's anointed because he spares Saul because he is the Lord's anointed. Now we have an instance where Nabal is not the Lord's anointed, and he wrongs David. He slights him, and the question becomes, will David still leave vengeance to the Lord? Okay, will David still leave vengeance to the Lord, or is this just reserved for the Lord's anointed? Of course, it should be for all. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord, I will repay. So just any time that vengeance, it's God's prerogative. And so chapter 25 really sets the precedent for the rest of David's life and his reign, where we see time and time again after this, once he becomes king, he doesn't seek his own revenge. He has lots of people who wrong him and so forth, but he doesn't seek his own revenge. He fights the Lord's battles, he fights the Lord's enemies, and he leaves his own enemies to the Lord to deal with. He never uses his position to pursue personal vendettas. In Abigail, we see an example of a godly woman married to a godless man, and as such, she is a veteran in dealing with impossible people, okay? She's a veteran at this, and she shows those skills off when she interacts with David. You can just imagine as we go through this chapter that she's done this many times with Nabal, and now she is doing so with David, who is, again, off track for the Lord in the chapter. Any questions or thoughts before we get into our passage? Okay, who would like to read verse 1 for us? Yes, Rory.
Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him. They buried him in his home in Ramah. Then David, moving down into the desert of Paran.
Thank you. Okay, so Samuel, he's an old, old man at this point. He was old when Saul was made king. Remember, he's talking about this constantly, that he is an old man. Saul reigned for nearly 40 years. Maybe he's in the mid-30s here as far as the year of his reign, 35 years. We're talking about an individual who lived probably to be over 100 years old, okay? And he signaled, Samuel signaled the end of the time of the judges. He was the last judge, and he was also the first of the prophets. So he was transitional in that regard, and he was the beginning of the school of the prophets, the advisors to the king. And previously, the judges had been the highest in the nation. They had been the leaders. Now the king is the authority, and he judges the nation. And the prophets that he, the schools of the prophets he sparked, would be advisors to these kings. And it says, all Israel gathered together and mourned for him. Is there any irony in a national mourning for Samuel? Why? Okay, yeah. They're complaining about him 35 years ago. That's how they got Saul. And of course, what maybe explains the change of heart here? They got Saul. And after 35 years, they longed to go back to Samuel. Okay, isn't it interesting how the Lord left Samuel there for 30-some years to let them just be a reminder of the past here. At this point, they are honoring him. You know, again, once people die, that's when the honor comes. Now, as we think about this, it says, and David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. You know, I'm pretty certain that David would have loved to have attended his funeral. But right now he's not. Okay, why is that? Okay, he's in hiding. But I thought Saul was feeling sorry. Yeah, David's still skeptical. He's still waiting to see here. Even though Samuel dies, and that would be a good, strong motive to go and go to his funeral and mourn with the nation for him, he heads in the opposite direction. Okay, he heads south. Yes.
And Samuel being very close and instrumental to David, so it would have been easy to think that David would have been there. Mm-hmm. So if Saul wanted another opportunity to perhaps go after David, this probably could have been a good thought.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, he would have opened himself up for sure. And so there was a real danger there. Amen. Okay. Oh, let's just talk about this briefly. And some of you, this may be reflected in some of your translations. Was it the wilderness of Paran or the wilderness of Maon? Now, the NASB, I think the King James, New King James says Paran. But Maon is also represented in the ancient text. The Septuagint says wilderness of Maon. Okay. And the wilderness of Maon, here we are in En-Gedi, okay, in the regions of En-Gedi. And that's where we left in chapter 24. Chapter 25, he's moving down here to the wilderness of Maon. And of course, that's really close to Maon and Carmel, where these events are taking place. Again, the NASB says Paran. What are we to make of this? This is actually reflected in the Masoretic text, okay, the Hebrew Bible, the Septuagint being the Greek translation of it. And as far as where Paran is extremely south. In fact, it would be regarded as outside of the land of Israel. That's the area from which Moses sent the spies out, okay, to survey the land. So this is Beersheba. This is the extreme south. The reference there, Numbers chapter 13, verses 2 through 3. So Beersheba, way down south. And when we look at that on a map, you're talking 80 miles between those two points where the events in Maon take place with the messengers and so forth. So very unlikely. There's a good reason. There's a geographic reason to think that Maon is in view here, not Paran. It's interesting when we look at like verse 18, it says there Abigail hurried. You know, why would she have to hurry if it's 80 miles away? That's a few days' trip. And then also, we also see in verse 4 that David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. It's kind of interesting, you know, would he be hearing that 80 miles away in Kadesh Barnea? Most likely, Maon is in view here. But again, both are represented in the ancient texts that we see. Any questions or thoughts here before we move on? Okay, you guys are being easy tonight. Who would like to read for us verses 2 through 4? Yes, Greg.
And there was a man in Malam whose possessions were in a farmer. The man was very great. He had 1,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in the farmer.
through verse 4. Okay, thank you. There was a man in Maon, it says, whose business was in Carmel. Again, just north of... Okay, I thought I had a map of this. There it is. Right here. This is Maon. Okay, just north is Carmel. And of course, there's also Mount Carmel. That's something altogether different. Okay, that's Mount Carmel. We're talking about the city or the village of Carmel. So Mount Carmel is way up here in the north. Of course, that has a connection with Elijah and so forth. That's a different location. But we're way down here, just kind of south of Hebron. Let me back up here if I can. There we go. We're down here. Here's Hebron. Okay, here's Gibeah of Saul. So we're way south. We're in this region right here, pretty much where David... Again, I believe the wilderness of Maon is where all this is taking place. And then he's been staying pretty much in this vicinity the entire time up until this point. Okay. Says, the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. Why is this important? Well, we see that his refusal is not because he lacked the means. Okay, he is an extremely wealthy person for that time. That's what's being conveyed here. He had the means to pay David, but he's refusing him for other reasons, which we are also enlightened to. This is also a unique time of year. It says it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Not only did he have means, but it was payday. Okay, this is when all the investment into the sheep and time and energy and so forth would be paying off as he would sell the wool. And Nabal, does anybody know what the word Nabal means? Surely you've heard this before. Worthless, fool. Okay, yeah, fool is the idea there, or worthless one. That's what his name means. Now, let me ask you this. What kind of parents name their kid fool or worthless one? Aim high, kid. You know, we called you fool for a reason. It's interesting here. He obviously never got past his childhood because he ended up being a harsh and evil person in his dealings, it says here. The word harsh means hard or severe. And you might say today that he drives a hard bargain. Okay, he always comes out ahead in his deals. And of course, at the expense of others, because it also mentions that he is evil. This both describes his dealings. He is harsh and he is evil in his dealings. That's what kind of businessman that he is. He was not above unethical practices to get one up on the person he was doing business with. Now, contrast his wife, Abigail. She is called intelligent, okay? This is literally of a good understanding. She's perceptive. You might use the phrase, she gets it. When we're going through this chapter, you see a woman who gets it. She gets her husband, she gets David, and she acts very wisely in light of the whole situation. She knows how to respond in these difficult circumstances. And it also says that she's beautiful in appearance. This is actually the same description given of David twice. Once we're told the same word is used to describe his eyes. He has beautiful eyes, 16:12, and handsome appearance. Same Hebrew word in 17:42. So this is used to describe David. And what we see in these two instances that sometimes outer beauty does reflect inner beauty. Okay, it does. It didn't with Saul, but it does with David and Abigail. Again, David, beautiful and godly. Saul, beautiful and ungodly. Abigail, beautiful and godly. I was thinking back on our study through here, and I think this fits into our discussion tonight as well. You have the folly of judging by relatives as well. Eli and sons, you have an ungodly father and an ungodly son. Samuel, you have a godly father and ungodly sons. And then in Saul, you have an ungodly father and a godly son. And so the point being, you can't judge according to appearance, nor can you judge people by their relatives. And as you think about this, aren't you happy that people don't judge you according to your relatives? Indeed, what we must look at, what must we judge in order to come to an accurate conclusion concerning someone? Yeah, and how do we know character? Their actions, yeah, their conduct, okay? So their conduct testifies to what they really are before God. Any questions or thoughts before we move on here? Okay, verses 5 through 8, who would like to read those? Yes, Dwinette. Okay, thank you. So David sends 10 young men. Now, I find this interesting because he has 600, but he only sends 10. So what does that tell us about how much he's asking?
Probably not much.
Not much. Only what 10 men could carry, okay? Only what 10 men could carry. So just the fact that 10 men are showing up, he's not asking for a tremendous amount here. I would also say that we see his character in the fact that he's not sending all 600 to intimidate Nabal. You could just imagine, I'm here to ask for something and 600 men are standing behind you. He said, you'd take the whole thing. Yeah, just go for it. He sends 10, which again, it wouldn't have been intimidating. He tells him to greet him in my name. Of course, this is the name of the Lord's anointed, the next king. And everybody knows this at this point. This is no secret. They are instructed to pronounce a blessing on Nabal, long life, peace on him and his family and his possessions. And they were to explain the benefit they were to Nabal's shepherds when they were out and about. They treated them well, and they also protected them, okay? And then, finally, ask... Oh, that's right. He asks them, ask your young men. Tell him to ask his young men to ask for a verification of this. And so clearly, Nabal's servants had expressed appreciation to David and his men while they were out there. He was confident they would give him a favorable testimony here. Now, finally, since it's payday, could you spare a little? Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son David. When we think about this request, well, the way we should understand this is there was nothing in the law that ever addressed this kind of situation. And so Nabal is not obligated in any way to do this. This was really what we might call a polite custom, a monetary token of appreciation. Can you think of in our culture, in our context, that where there's a monetary token of appreciation? Yeah, a tip. We have the same custom, same thing that's going on here. When you think of an individual in a restaurant who doesn't leave a tip, what are you in our culture?
A cheapskate.
A cheapskate, okay. Yeah, you're a rude person, you're selfish. You're unappreciative. Now, if you fail to pay your bill, what kind of person are you? Deadbeat? A thief. Yeah, you're breaking the law then. Okay, you've crossed a line. So that's what we're looking at here is a tip. Well, that's rude not to tip. But to not pay your bill, there's an obligation there. And so then you become a thief. You're doing something illegal. Now, what do you think is one of the characteristics of a person who is harsh and evil in his dealings? Yeah, he doesn't leave tips. That's the last thing he does. He doesn't care about such things. There's nothing gracious and appreciative about him. He's rude and selfish. So he doesn't tip. And that's what we see in verses 9 through 12. Who would like to read those for? Any questions before we move on? Yes, Tom. It's definitely rude, selfish, and and unappreciative, and you might be dangerously close to being Nabal. Tom, we don't want to know your practices. Just, you know, keep it to yourself. Well, you know, it's interesting. By the end of this chapter, he's dead. So, okay, well, who wants to read verses 9 through 12? Okay, go ahead.
So when David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all the words that in the name of David and waited. Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away each one from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men when I do not know where they are from?" To what verse?
Verse 12.
So David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and told him all these words.
Okay, thank you. They spoke to Nabal according to all these words in David's name. Then they waited. Why is that phrase thrown in there? What is that indicating? And they waited. Okay, yeah. And here he is. And I think of, you know, this guy and how he does business. And certainly he was an egotist. And it's kind of one of these things where, yeah, I'm going to answer you. Let me think about how I'm going to answer you. He's coming up with a really smart-alecky thing to say. He really ends up belittling David here. He wants to orchestrate this in such a way that he not just tells him no, but he insults him while he's at it, okay? And that's what he ends up doing here. He's crafting his response. Nabal, he begins, "Who is David and who is the son of Jesse?" What's the answer to that question? Okay, he's the next king. He's the Lord's anointed. We've heard this time and time again, and people know this now. Of course, he's saying this to insult him. Like, who's that? Should that name mean something to me? What does Nabal imply that he is with his words here? Okay, the superior to David. Anything else in his response? Okay, a servant who what? Yeah, he's a renegade slave, okay? He's a renegade slave, of course, referring to Saul. Yeah, you've taken off from your master. That's what you are, and then you're coming to me begging. You know, I've got my own servants to feed. I've got my own slaves to feed. Why am I going to feed somebody else's slaves? Go back to your master, okay? Shall I take my bread and water and meat that I have slaughtered for my shearers? This is for me and mine. And give it to those whose origin I do not know. I don't know who you are. He's expressing disdain for David. He's insulting him. Any questions or thoughts here before we move on?
Jason, you kind of touched a little bit, but I think that verse 11, there is an emphasis on mine. You know, this is mine, and I'm not going to share it. And in particular, I'm not going to share it with you. I do not recognize you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Good observation. Yes, Rory.
I also was thinking, when you said that, back to where it says in verse 9, then they waited.
Mm-hmm.
I think it could be. I don't know for sure, of course, but maybe the men weren't even allowed into the house where Nabal was, and the message was brought to him, and he answered his servants who went back outside. That's what it almost looked like to me.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, not all that's described, but sure.
Right. Just the way it says that they waited, they gave Nabal this message in David's name. Of course, that's talking about the men, so it's hard to tell whether they had a face-to-face.
Right. It indicates something unique because that expression, then they waited. I mean, usually it's he replied or he answered, and there's no pause.
Well, I think that the idea that they waited is that Nabal made him wait.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't respect
Yeah, I'll get to you. Just hold on. Yeah, I see this guy's ego on display. Yeah, for sure. Yep. Anyone else? Tom. Okay.
Nabal says, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse?" Obviously, he probably wouldn't have reacted to that had he known the man.
Well, he's a fool. Yeah. Yeah, you know, as far as all the details there, I wouldn't necessarily see David's motives there. I think he's sending 10 men, give me what's on hand. You know, just give me a little gratuity here. This was a common custom in that day, polite thing to do for those in these kinds of situations. At any rate, let's go ahead and move on, or we're going to run out of time. Who would like to read for us verses 9 through 12? Oh, I'm sorry. Verse 13. Yeah, we're in a hurry. Verse 13. Who would like to read that? Okay, Burke.
David said to his men, "Each of you gird on his sword." So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. About 400 men went up behind David, while 600 stood with the baggage.
Okay. Boy, David doesn't waste any time here, does he? He skipped the intimidation step. He went straight to murder, okay? Again, his conscience isn't working. Remember we talked about last time he cut the edge of Saul's robe and his conscience bothered him after? Well, again, his conscience isn't really kicking in here. Nothing slows him down except for Abigail. He straps on his sword, his intentions are clear. And he started down the path of revenge. But there's also someone else at work here to intercept him. Any questions or thoughts there about verse 13?
You know, this is our response in anger.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when the flesh gets in the way, we will respond like God at any time. You know, then somebody can talk to us and, you know, make us make sense a little bit, bring us back.
Yeah, very impulsive. Absolutely. Definitely very clear here. Anyone else? Okay, well, let's look at Abigail here. Verses 14 through 17. Who would like to read those for us? Jane.
Now, one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields. They were a wall to us both by night and day, all the time we were with them keeping the sheep. Now, therefore, know and consider what you will do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his household, for he is such a scoundrel that one cannot speak."
Okay, thank you. Now, women, don't start chuckling. There are men out there like this, right? No one can speak to him. Here we are, verse 14. This is interesting. He scorned them. The idea is he screamed at them. Or, you know, he spoke. This really speaks of the tone of his voice here. He was not polite in his tone. And the servant confirms that David's men were a blessing. And that he will surely be cursed. He'll become a curse against them. How did he know this? Remember, these men spent time out in the field with David's men. Okay, they got to know them. And here they watch these 10 walk away. I wonder what their expressions were when they walked out of his presence. I'm sure they weren't happy. And they're looking at this and how it's unfolding. It's like, he's got 600 men. I think this is the end of us. And he said, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. Now, he's not telling her something that she doesn't already know. But that statement is made and included in the text for us to realize just what kind of individual we're talking with here. These servants couldn't go to him and explain to him what the potential danger was here. He is described, the word worthless here is literally son of Belial, which is familiar to those of us, for us in 1 Samuel, because this is the title given to Eli's sons. Okay, they were worthless men. They were sons of Belial. And of course, we know what kind of characters they were. He's in that same category, that same class of people. And no one can speak to him. No one can speak to him. What is it about a person that no one can speak to them? Okay, they view themselves as the supreme authority. Anything else?
Pride.
Yes. They obviously think very highly of themselves and don't think that anyone has anything to add to them. If I could move on here. This is out of the book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 15. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man is he who listens to counsel. Note the contrast there. Fool, he doesn't need any advice. He's got it all figured out. That's what kind of person we're dealing with here. But a wise man, he listens to counsel. Proverbs 9, 7, he who corrects a scoffer gets dishonor for himself. And he who reproves a wicked man gets insults for himself. We've already seen him insult some individuals. That's what he would do to anyone who tried to give him any kind of advice. In the case of David, he gives him some help that he needed. And again, he gets rebuffed for it. He gets scoffed at. When a wise man has a controversy with a foolish man, the foolish man either rages or laughs, and there is no peace. Again, just another example of a person that you just can't even talk to. They're either going to mock you or they're going to rage against you, but there's really not going to be a resolution. That's the kind of person Nabal is. He who separates himself seeks his own desire. He quarrels against all sound wisdom. A fool does not delight in understanding, but only in the revealing of his own mind. Again, if people won't listen to him, he just separates himself. He doesn't want to hear any kind of counsel or correction or anything of that nature. He quarrels against sound wisdom, okay? So he just goes on his way. Through insolence comes nothing but strife, but wisdom is with those who receive counsel. Again, that quality of being a wise individual means that you hear others out and you listen and you weigh options that are suggested to you. Listen to counsel and accept discipline that you may be wise the rest of your days. And then, better is open rebuke than love that is concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Boy, you should be really unnerved when you have an individual who just tells you what you want to hear all the time, right? A real friend, why? He's going to rebuke. He's going to wound sometimes. And here's an individual that, frankly, he's not listening for such things. And he's going to pay dearly for it because David is on his way with 400 men. Any questions or thoughts before we move on? Yes, Rory. Sure. He didn't care. He's partying it up later. I mean, he's throwing a big party for himself. And so, yes, he's oblivious. Go ahead.
And there is also a very discerning young man because he is able to tell what's going on.
Yeah.
What's going to happen. And you know, he saved the whole people.
Yeah.
He knows who to go to get things taken care of.
There you go. Yep, that is a good point. And he's one of the what? Young men. Yeah, that's right. He's one of the young men, and here's Nabal. You know, he's shrewd, but he's a fool. You know, he's good at doing evil, but not so wise in doing what is right. Okay. Well, who would like to read for us verses 18 through 19? Yes, well, Greg, you read once, right? Yeah. Did you read? Okay. Kate, how about you read?
Sure. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 sheep of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, loaded them all down. She said to her
Okay, thank you. What does Abigail know about men? The way to a man's heart is through his stomach, right? She's looking at this and she says, David, he's a man. He's just hangry, right? Are you familiar with the term hangry? It's an adjective. Irritable as a result of being hungry. And all the women said amen. We've all battled hanger. It's interesting here. She sets out to intercept David, but she doesn't tell her husband. And we already know why. He's not going to listen. Okay? He's not going to listen. She does ultimately inform him to his own demise, but she informs him the next day, but she's kind of operating by the principle it's better to beg forgiveness than ask permission at this point, because she knows the right thing to do, she knows what's going to change the situation, and she just doesn't want him getting in the way. She's dealing with a fool who will not listen. And so, therefore, she takes matters into her own hands. And she's commended for this. There's nothing but a positive portrayal of her in the scriptures here. There's nothing negative. There's nothing condemning. She is a positive example of a woman who's trying to be godly when she's married to an ungodly man. Okay? And we'll talk more about that next time, because that really comes to life here in the second half of the chapter. Any questions or thoughts here? Yes.
Mm-hmm. She was going to resolve that.
Yeah. Yeah, she springs into action, and the young man, he's advising her that way, or, you know, telling her of the situation. So she has a clear read on this. She agrees, and she goes. That's right. Anyone else? Yes, Rory.
When you think about how dumb Nabal, how much food are they packing up and cooking and preparing and taking out? He's not wiser. Even now, he's
throwing a party for himself. And so as this is going on, as we see as we go on, he's throwing a party for himself. Yeah.
That's a lot of preparation of food and a lot of men and resources to take that out.
Sure. Okay. Yep. Anyone else? Okay, who would like to read for us verses 20 through 22? Yes, Jeremy. Okay, thank you. So we're given, this is when she's meeting him, and it takes us back. It says, now David had said, okay? This is now, we're given what he's been muttering to himself all the way to Nabal's residence here. He's been muttering to himself, surely in vain I've guarded all that this man has. Is that true? Well, he certainly believes that.
It's like the waiter who doesn't get the tip.
Okay. Remember that. Yes, he certainly believes this, and he's thinking this, and he's muttering it to himself, but biblically speaking, is it true? Okay, yeah, let's look at some scriptures here. Proverbs 25:21 says this, if your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat, and if he is thirsty, give him water to drink, for you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. So, yeah, you did all this service for him, you were a protection to him, and he didn't recognize that, but you know what? The Lord will reward you. You won't receive it here on earth, but you will when you stand before the Lord. Luke 6:35, Jesus says the same thing, but love your enemies and do good and lend and expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great. And you will be sons of the Most High, for he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. By the end of this chapter, I mean, this becomes David's MO. This is how he operates. At the end of the day, he doesn't seek his own revenge. He doesn't go after anybody. He's just patient when wronged, okay? He fights the Lord's battles and the Lord's enemies, not his own. He leaves them to the Lord. So here, let's see now, what else does he say? He says, yes.
And maybe even because he had a sense that he deserved part of it, or because he was insulted, or maybe a combination of both.
Right.
It really made him angry.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because when he sent the first message, very gracious, not pushy. And I think what really sent him over the edge was the insult, you know, the tone and everything as it came back. Suddenly, we're going to get everything. We're going to get a whole lot more than we asked for the first time. Yes.
And I honestly think we might have missed something here because there's no doubt Nabal knew what David did.
Sure.
Those folks out there told him exactly what David did. They protected the sheep.
Mm-hmm. It's still, even though he's been slighted, I mean, there's nothing that says that he should have paid him. I mean, there's nothing in the law.
Correct.
Yeah, it was, there was nothing obligation here.
No, but culturally, he should have.
Sure.
That says you have to give a tip.
Yeah, it's about like a tip. You're rude. You're selfish. You know, you're unthinking there, but yeah.
It's a cultural thing to do.
That's right. And this kind of, it balloons out. it suddenly becomes way bigger than it should be, and that becomes clear as Abigail turns him back from this. It says, returned me evil for good. Yes, he has. Okay, he has insulted him in his response. And so David pronounces a curse. May God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him. By the end of this, David should be grateful that he cursed his enemies because he doesn't end up killing Nabal. But he pronounces this curse here. He is muttering this over and over and over again all the way there. And he plans to kill every male. Who has a New American Standard Bible? Could you read the margin on the note there on male? Oh, you don't? There's not a little one or anything by it? Does anybody have marginal notes? Okay, Burke, go for it. Okay, yes. One who urinates against a wall. So last week we talked about number two. Yes. Actually, the King James, I didn't have somebody read the King James because it would probably be regarded as vulgar slang today because of the word that it uses there. But it does literally translate it there in the King James. Interestingly enough, this is not the only place it occurs in Scripture, this description of a man. The expression appears in prophecies from God concerning the house of Jeroboam and concerning the house of Ahab, which really speaks to, I think it was pejorative. I think there was, you know, kind of like calling somebody the son of Jesse. There was this insulting aspect to it. And of course, clearly he's referring to men here, even though the description is you walk into a men's restroom, you know, where are the receptacles? They're on the wall. Okay, so clearly men are in view here. Well, the stage is set. The stage is set for this dramatic encounter now between Abigail and David. And the dialogue here, again, the lengthiest we have from a woman in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel here. In fact, someone pointed out that it was the lengthiest statement from a woman, single statement from a woman, apart from Deborah's song that she wrote. And so we have a lengthy quote here from a woman that isn't paralleled elsewhere in Scripture. Anyone else before we close here today? Yes.
I know it's coming next week, but I think of Abigail, Jason. See the foolishness of Nabal, see the anger of David, and then you think of probably a gentle answer, kind of the way wrath.
That's right.
And she just wisely says, David, calm down. You're going to be the king.
That's right. Yep. You're getting ahead of me. Yes.
It would be interesting to know the background, how she ever ends up with this fool.
Yeah.
I mean, she's such a beautiful, wise woman, and she ends up with such a fool.
That's right.
I suppose there's a lot of women in that role.
Yeah. Yeah. A tough situation to be in. And that's what I mean. I think this is a very good passage for a woman to go through and for a man, especially a man. I think the major lesson is for a man, but also for a woman functioning in that difficult context of being married to a fool. Yes. Oh, yeah. It just seems to be an idiom for males. Yeah, derogatory idiom for males. Yeah. So, yes. Yes, they were. I guess, you know, you sit there and say, who would name their kid Nabal? And then who would give their daughter to a man named Nabal? but, what was that? He had a lot of sheep. That's right. He paid the dowry. He paid well. He paid well. That's right. All right. Well, let's go ahead and take some prayer requests here. We'll move on. We're running out of time. Okay.